My name is Chris Grum, and I am spending this whole week talking about various kinds of ethical dilemmas in reproductive health. And my job requires me to come into contact with all of these on a more personal, intimate basis, because for the last 20 years, I've been working in the area of reproductive health. Currently, I'm the executive director of an organization called Education Program Associates that trains healthcare workers, nurse practitioners, nurse midwives, physician's assistants, and physicians in reproductive health care in a variety of different settings. And that ranges anywhere from family planning clinics to prenatal clinics to infertility clinics, et cetera. So a lot of the cases that I bring to you are cases that we've worked with either within our agency personally or with staff who have worked with those particular cases. Now, the subject of today is entitled Women as Fetal Containers. And basically what we're going to be talking about is what happens to women during their pregnancy when they choose not to particularly exercise healthy behaviors, which might include using drugs, which might include smoking, not taking care of themselves if they're a diabetic, not taking their insulin, and you could go on and on. And what happens when the state enters into that and the legal system enters into that and criminalization takes place and they're put in jail or they're confined to hospitals, etc.? Or the other situation we're going to be looking at is what happens to women when they have what we call court-ordered cesarean sections. When the physician says this is what should happen, the woman says no, the physician goes to the court, and the court orders the woman that she has to have a cesarean section. So before we get started, what I want to do is I want to do a forced choice exercise with you. Some of you who are here on Monday got a chance to do that, but I want to do that again because we're going to talk about a totally different topic area. And usually I like to start the forced choice with something a little easy to get you gradually into it, and then we go for the big questions. So what the forced choice is, you're going to get two choices, and the people upstairs don't have to come down. They can just stay on that end or that end. And you're going to get two choices in the forced choice, and you have to choose one or the other. There's nothing in between. There's no maybe. Those are the only two choices left in the world. So the first choice, the first forced choice is that you have a choice to go on vacation on only two places in the entire world. Okay, this is where you're going to vacation for. There are only two places. Over here is Holden Village, and over here is Europe. So move very quickly to where you want to be. There are only two places in the world. Holden Village here, Europe is over there. The loyalties crumble. That's right. Europe is over here. Oh, anywhere. Okay. All right, have people found their place? Are these all the Europe travelers? And these are all the Holden travelers? Okay. Holden people, why did you pick this? What is it?
It's relaxing.
It's relaxing. Okay, what else? It's beautiful.
Financial,
it's cheaper. Okay. What else?
Learn more here.
You learn more here. Good food.
Well,
you've been here before, so you know it. Oh, you've been to Europe, so you want to do something different. You've already experienced that. Okay.
Community.
Community. Okay, you can get community with that. What else? Anything else?
The food.
The food. Now, I haven't told this group yet, but this is an advertisement for Holden Village. It's all being taped for the next session. Okay, what about the Europe people?
I've been to Holden.
You've been to Holden, so you want to do something new.
My wife will kill me if I don't take her to Europe.
There's a lot of guilt in you every time you do this. That's right. A lot of threats here. What else?
I'm not here on vacation.
You're not here on vacation. So Europe would be more of a vacation. Okay. So you have a different reason why you go to one place or the other. All right, what else?
A lot more to learn over there.
Okay, so what's interesting is people, again, remember this, people have the same reasons. There was a person over here who said you learn a lot. What you're saying is you learn a lot, but you'd go to two different places possibly to do it.
A larger amount of places.
Okay.
Food's terrific.
Food is terrific, okay? We have two great food food here. Okay. Anything else?
History and scenery.
History. Okay. So once again, what we do when we do the forced choice is that we find out that basically what happens to people is they sometimes can make different decisions for the exact same reason, or have the same make the same decision for very different reasons. And that's what happens in ethical dilemmas. So let's try a dilemma right now and see what you would do with it. There are two positions that you can have in the world around the issue of fetal maternal conflict. And over here, during pregnancy, for the people over here, the fetus is always given first priority without any consideration of the woman. The fetus is always given first priority in the medical field. That's the basic belief. That's how the medical system and healthcare system is done in this area. In this area, the woman is always given first priority in the pregnancy, regardless. It doesn't matter how far along the pregnancy is. It doesn't matter what it is. The woman is always given first consideration. So find your position, which side that you would be on, and we'll talk about it. All right, let's start with this group first. What are some of the reasons why people find themselves over here? Okay. So for you, it's knowing, it's the certainty of it that defines it for you. All right. Anybody else? Why are you over on this side? Yes.
I figured if I considered the wants of the woman, there'd be a chance for the fetus too, because that woman is going to want to have concern for the fetus.
Okay, so you're depending upon the goodwill of the woman to make a decision that will also enhance the life of the fetus. Okay? Same? Okay, what else?
I have six children. I don't want to lose my wife for selfish reasons.
Okay, so you're kind of making the decision based on kind of value of, for you personally. Yeah?
You can always have another child.
Okay, right. Okay, yes. Okay, so it may be you're making a value judgment related to that. Anything else? Okay, and why does she have pre-existing rights? Okay, because she came first? Okay, is some of that related to the fact that we see and feel and know this person versus the fetus that we don't see and feel and know?
Okay.
Does that impact it?
Real first.
Okay. Okay. All right, let's talk over here. What about this group? Yes.
I'm just listening.
Oh, all right. You're passing. All right. Hey. Part of this is that people can say what they want to say without... I would do neither.
It seems like too few people anymore want to give the fetus any rights. The fetus didn't ask to be conceived. The fetus is there. And there's also an element that I kind of disagree about, the all of one side or all of another, because I don't think your situation here providing us with two camps is quite all real world.
Right. Part of this is not all real world. Part of this is to get the discussion moving in a direction. But basically what you would say is that for you, the fetus has to be protected because it doesn't have the same power and ability to make decisions that the woman does, and therefore it requires some kind of protection.
Is that? Protecting the fetus, by definition, is not going to kill the mother.
Okay. Well, it can happen.
You're going to have a fetus.
You know, it can happen either way, in either camp. But that would be what yours is. Okay. Other people in this group.
Why call it fetus? That's a bad word to me. Why not say baby?
Because at that stage, technically, that's the term.
Fetus is kind of an ugly word.
So for you, the issue is you would see it as a baby having equal rights or more rights than the mother. Okay. So you struggle with that, but you know in your mind that you have some.
Because it's degrading.
Okay. Well, that's what I'm going to be using during this time for a lot of different reasons, which we can talk about afterwards if you'd like to.
We don't know the potential of that child.
Okay. Okay, so it might be, you know, who knows? It might be a great leader, it might be a genius, etc. So you don't weigh necessarily the fact that you know this. To you, the unknown is as important as the known. Okay? Anything else? Over here.
Even Da Vinci was illegitimate.
Yeah, there are a lot. That's true. Okay, what I think we're talking about is, and what I want you to kind of focus on as we have this discussion, is that whole question of what we call maternal-fetal conflict.
And this has only recently become an issue because of medical technology. So why don't you all sit down and we will start the process. Yeah. To start us out today, and we're going to end again with two case studies. So you're going to get a chance to do a lot of talking and sharing about your particular feelings. And I do want to say again that one of the things that's real important about this kind of discussion group is within the context of it that we listen very carefully to what other people are saying, even though we may not necessarily agree with them. One of the issues that's so difficult in all of these is people automatically kind of make their stance known and then people stop listening because they make assumptions about what the next thing the person is going to say. So I would ask that you listen very carefully in your small groups as you go through this process of looking at this very, very painful issue, and there's a lot of struggle in this particular field, partly because it's new. What I want to do to kind of set it up, however, is I want to talk to you about what's happening in our country with maternal and child health, because that greatly impacts the questions that we're going to be talking about this afternoon. And I just want to go through real quickly some recent data done on a study by a guy who looked at 10 countries in Europe, all different varying countries in terms of economics and in terms of healthcare systems, in relationship to the U.S. and our maternal and child healthcare system. And basically, the U.S. came out on the bottom of those 10 countries in terms of infant mortality, the number of infants who die. The U.S. was at the bottom, even though the U.S. out of all those countries spent the most money in healthcare. And there are a lot of different reasons for that. In the U.S., a little more than half of the OBGYNs will see, that's obstetricians, gynecologists, will see women who are funded on public funding. A little over half. In fact, in some counties, there are no physicians who are available to see women who are on government funding. So sometimes those women in those counties have no access. 25% of women in primary childbearing age are not protected by either public or private health insurance. They neither have access to government monies or to health insurance. And therefore, when they get pregnant, they don't have access to money to get prenatal care. 20% of pregnant women, and even a greater proportion of minority women, fail to receive early prenatal care. In fact, 10% of women in the black community and 12% of women in the Hispanic community do not receive, get pregnant, do not receive prenatal care until the third trimester. And if you understand anything about maternal and child health, the first two trimesters are extremely important in terms of the development of the fetus. That the necessary health care in terms of good nutrition and exercise and what doesn't go into the body and what does happens those first two trimesters. And it's becoming a major problem. Birth weight is a major problem in this country. It's the reason why we have such a high infant mortality rate and problems. In rural and urban areas, as I said before, prenatal care is not always available. Between these countries and the 10 European countries, we have the highest rate of teenage pregnancy. And part of that is increased access in those other countries to contraception and to teenagers participating, and children even at a lower age, participating in good sex education programs. The European rate of teen pregnancy dramatically decreased in about the 1970s. It's increasing in this country. A million teenagers a year become pregnant. A million every year become pregnant. That's between the ages of 15 and 19. One of the things that they found in terms of better health care for pregnant women in those European countries was not so much, and these are not all countries with socialized medicine, but what they found was access to prenatal care was one of the number one issues. Ability to take time off from work was another one of the issues. Ability to have available resources like good food, healthy food, etc., was another one of those. Interestingly enough, in our country, the cesarean rate section, and that's the procedure that happens to a woman when she doesn't deliver vaginally, but they cut through the abdominal wall and they deliver the baby that way, the cesarean rate in our country is higher than any of those 10. In fact, almost 25% or 1 in 4 pregnancies in this country end up in a cesarean section, or what we call a C-section. It's an extremely high, high number. Health of poverty and minority children has worsened in this country since 1981. And the consequences of poor prenatal care not only trigger tragedy in human conditions, but it's ending up costing our healthcare system thousands and thousands of dollars. People, pregnant women who do not receive prenatal care, their babies are 5 times more likely to die in the first year. More than 1.5 times more likely to experience handicaps or disabilities because of low birth weight. So we're talking the lack of availability of prenatal care greatly impacts the health care of children. That for an infant who ends up in intensive care in a hospital, it could cost as low as $19,000 and up to $200,000. But a woman who, a baby that costs $19,000, 19 women can get adequate prenatal care for that same $19,000. So a lot of those babies who end up in intensive care are there because prenatal care was not available to them at all. That's the backdrop behind which the issues that I'm going to talk about in terms of maternal-fetal conflict fall. And it's important to remember that backdrop, because that impacts a lot of the decision-making that those pregnant women do as they move through the process. The other thing that we're going to focus on is I've put this up again, and this lists the ethical areas that relate to good medical ethics, informed consent, confidentiality, benefit risk, right to refuse treatment and justice, and then on the side of the Christian ethics we need to look at are importance of human life, respect for others, responsibility for humanity and rest of creation, accountability to God, and freedom of gospel. Those are all the things that we need to be thinking about. In particular today, I want us to look at the issue of confidentiality, the issue of right to refuse treatment, because these are two key issues that are going to come up, the issue of responsibility towards humanity and rest of creation, and respect for others. Those are some of the issues that we're going to focus on. In terms of what's happening in the area of maternal-fetal conflict, one of the problems is a lot of people don't hear about it because it appears in very small little print in the newspaper. Periodically, there's a major case. One of the things that is occurring is that there's an increased number of what we call court-ordered cesarean sections. And these are happening when women go to a physician and the physician says, I think that you need a cesarean section in order to deliver a healthy baby. And the woman says, I don't believe in cesarean sections. I will not have one. That's not the treatment that I want. And the doctor says, or the hospital says, we are going to go to court and a judge is going to decide whether you should get a cesarean section or not. And remember the right to refuse treatment as we think about this. Probably one of the most prominent cases related to this was a woman in Washington, D.C., who had cancer at age 13. It had been in remission. She got pregnant. She was now 24, 25. She'd gotten pregnant, and about the 6th or 7th month of her pregnancy, I think actually it was the 6th, she went into the hospital and the cancer reappeared. She was very, very ill. In the hospital decided that they didn't think they could save her, but they wanted to try to save the fetus. And at that point, the viability issue was there. In other words, could the fetus or the baby survive outside the body of the mother at that particular stage? It was very questionable. She was definitely on the border. The physician, the woman's private physician, the woman herself, the woman's husband, the woman's parents, all chose not to have the procedure because the procedure, everybody knew, would hasten her death. They knew that if she had this procedure, that she would die sooner, and they did not feel that the fetus was going to be viable. And so what their choice was is to see if she could hang on longer, continue the pregnancy a little longer, so even if she did die, the fetus would be more developed with the possibility of a live birth. What happened is, within a six-hour period of time, the hospital went to the courts, and the courts ordered that woman to have a cesarean section. Her family had 4 hours to give that information. They were never told to get a lawyer. They were never told that they could engage legal help, and they were never told that they could share the information that they had specifically with the judge. So the woman was forced to go into surgery. She had a cesarean section. 2 hours later, the baby died, and 2 days later, she died. So the court-ordered cesarean section did not help anybody in the process. And in fact, now it's being looked at in retrospect for the possibility, the family has sued, for the possibility of violation of human rights. One of the interesting parts of this story and tragedies is this was also a family with no money. That the number of court-ordered cesarean sections are happening primarily to who? To poor women, women of color, and women whose language is, primary language is other than English. Almost exclusively, that's where it is occurring. There are very rare cases where a physician in private practice with a middle-class practice will ever take one of his pregnant clients to court. Because what would happen? He would lose his entire client population. And he knows that, or she knows that. So one of the things that's real concerning about the court-ordered C-sections is are the people that it's affecting. Now, court orders to push women to stay in hospitals or to get C-sections have been obtained in 11 states. And in two states, the court orders are mandating hospital detention of pregnant women. In other words, a woman comes in, she's a diabetic, she is not taking her insulin properly or maybe eating the right kind of food. The doctor says you're not following proper procedure. I am going to go to the courts and I'm going to ask them to keep you, force you to stay in the hospital until you deliver. And that way, we will force you to take your insulin and you will have to eat certain foods. And in a number of situations, the courts have ordered that particular thing. Of all the cases reported in the New England Journal of Medicine, this was a study done, all have been medically indigent. 81% have been black, Asian, or Hispanic, and 24% didn't speak English as their primary language. Incredibly high statistics related to that. There are a lot of questions because originally when you talked about obstetrics, you are talking about the care of pregnant women. Now you're talking about the care of pregnant women and the fetus. So many doctors find themselves in the position of treating two patients whose medical problems may conflict with each other. And therefore, you've produced a major ethical dilemma in the United States. Now, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists totally disapproves of going to court for healthcare treatment. They feel basically that it decreases the trust between the patient and the doctor. And what else does it do? What do you think the other thing that the American College is worried about? Yes. Huh?
Takes the control out of the position.
It puts the control more into it, so then it means that the possibility of a lawsuit. Right. I mean, we're talking the difference between saying to a client in the privacy of a room, this is what you should do, and going to the courts and saying, we think you should do this, and then if the result occurs that it's not a healthy baby, that it's not a healthy, invasive surgery or whatever treatment was wrong, then they can be sued. In fact, there's a case of a woman, a black woman who's 24 years old. She walked into the hospital and the doctors there said, you have to have a cesarean section. She said, for religious reasons, I do not believe in surgery. They said, but you have to. If you have a vaginal delivery, there's a 99% chance that the baby will not be born healthy. if you have a vaginal delivery. She said, I won't do it. I won't accept it. They took it to court. In this case, the courts deliberated a little too long, and she delivered a very healthy baby vaginally. Now, one of the problems is that you're dealing with the question of an unknown, some uncertainties in medicine, going to the court, making very final decisions. And it becomes a major problem for the courts. So in essence, particularly in the case of the woman in Washington, D.C., a judge who had absolutely no medical information, had no understanding. In fact, he did not even know how a cesarean section was performed. He had to go to the hospital and find out. Made a judgment about forcing a woman to have a cesarean section based on what he called legal issues. So one of the things that we're running into is the number of cases that are moving out of the hospital, out of the healthcare system, into the courts, and the decisions are being made in that particular way. The other thing that the New England study said was that 1/4 of the OBs thought women who refused medical advice and thereby endangered the life of the fetus should be detained by the hospital or some other facility. Now, think of this a little further. What happens if a woman smokes, which we know is detrimental to the fetus? Should that woman be put in the hospital for the remainder of her pregnancy, not allowed to smoke, and when she has the delivery, she can walk out and smoke all she wants? What happens when a woman doesn't eat exactly what the doctor said she should eat nutritiously during the pregnancy? How many of you in here have ever, for even the smallest thing, disobeyed an order of your doctor? How many? Okay. The same kinds of things are occurring. So we need to think, again, we need to think about these court decisions in relationship to the setting up of precedent within our society. And there's all kinds of possibilities that could happen. And again, they primarily happen to poor and low-income women because they have only certain places where they are forced to go for their health care. All right, moving real quickly from that, I want to talk a little bit about drug-exposed babies. I want to give you some information on that, and then we'll move to our case studies. Every year, 375,000 drug-exposed babies are born in this country. 85% of those children are born from moms who use cocaine. And about the same rate, interestingly enough, of addicted babies are born in hospitals located in rural, in urban, in low-income, and upper-income, and middle-income communities. We're not talking about all of those addicted babies being born in low-income communities in the city. And yet, the focus has been primarily and only on low-income women in terms of the kind of charges that have been brought against them. Cocaine babies, just to give you this, up until recently were considered to, once they got through the initial period of withdrawing from the cocaine or the initial effects in the hospital, it was thought that maybe they could be very healthy. Current thought is radically different because these kids are now growing up and now moving into preschool. And the problems that are attached to them are growing problems in terms of behavior problems. They have no social skills in many cases. They're hyperactive. They have a short attention span. They are unable... I'm stuck in here. They are unable to process information. They fly off the handle. They have very quick tempers. They're physically awkward. They are rigid, like many brain-damaged children are. They're unable to sleep oftentimes for long periods of time, and they have nightmares. In fact, they are now beginning to develop whole new classes for these kids because they can't put them in traditional schools because they just can't function within a traditional schedule of a school day. So we're talking about kids where the problem is not only at birth, we're talking about a lifetime of problems in these particular cases. The same thing is true of fetal alcohol syndrome and the kind of damage that happens to children for women who drink very heavily during their pregnancy. Same types of problems occur. So we know that we're talking some long-term effects. However, in that process, the other thing you need to understand is there are very few treatment programs that will take both an addict and a pregnant woman. They're very nervous about treating pregnant addicts. Because in our healthcare system, we've defined ourselves by those people who work in drug and alcohol abuse and those people who work in maternal and child health. And so a woman who sits in the middle, and those people don't communicate, I know, because I work on both of those, and it's impossible. A woman who sits in the middle has a hard time getting either one of those groups to take responsibility for. They are not nice clients. They are not easy clients. They don't do what you tell them. They're hard. They're uncomfortable, and the process of delivering is very painful in many cases, both for the caregiver and for the woman and for the baby. It's not an easy place to be, but many women have no access to health care. There is not oftentimes a lot of screening that takes place in early prenatal care. So not only do they have not access to health care as women who are drug users, they don't have access to prenatal care. Now, what are some of the things that are occurring legislatively in many states? One is mandatory screening. All women, in some states, they're asking for all women to be tested early in their pregnancy to decide whether they have drugs in their system. If they do, some legislators are suggesting that they should be, they have two choices. They can go into a rehab program or they can go off to jail and get rid of their addiction there, have their go through their pregnancy there. At the end of their pregnancy, they are let out of jail. There is a whole series of legislation that is taking place related to the issue of taking children away from drug-using moms on delivery, and the kid is immediately taken away. I'm not going to get into this now, but if any of you are familiar with the foster care system in this country, it stinks. That kids in foster care, for the most part, are much more abused than oftentimes they are if they stay in the homes that they were originally born into. It's a real problem in this country. There are not enough good foster care homes for those babies. So the babies end up being in a more problematic state. Recently, in Florida, a woman was convicted, and this is kind of the final major piece, a woman was convicted of manslaughter for delivering a baby that she used cocaine during the whole pregnancy. She was actually convicted of manslaughter. That's one of the first cases. And we're waiting. I haven't heard. That happened about 2 weeks ago, what her sentence was. But Florida legislature is considering increasing the penalties against women who use drugs and deliver babies. So we're talking about suddenly a healthcare, public health issue. Instead of dealing with it as a healthcare issue, we've now done what with it? We've criminalized it. We've criminalized it. So we've taken it out a whole new realm and put it into another realm with a whole new series of problems. And for anybody who's done any work in the prison system, you should know and should be aware of the fact that we already are overcrowded in our prison system. And anybody who thinks it's healthier to have a baby in jail than to have a baby outside, even if you're using cocaine, has no idea what it's like in prison conditions. And they are incredible in terms of pregnant women. So it becomes a major problem. Also, for most of the women who get incarcerated in prison during their pregnancy, it's automatically assumed that the baby's going to be taken away from them. So the question then comes, are women who are pregnant in our society going to start being treated differently than everybody else? Are we going to move and deal with their confidentiality, because many hospitals and doctors are being required to report to their local district attorney whether a woman's drug test came out positive or negative. Suddenly violates the rule of confidentiality between doctor-patient. What about the right of refusal for treatment for women who are forced to get cesarean sections? We've always accepted this as a right of people who are, you know, alive and able to make the decision. Suddenly that changes. However, what about the issue of our responsibility towards that fetus or the baby? What happens with that? What do we weigh? And what becomes the kind of precedence that we want to set in our society in terms of how we want to treat people as they confront some of their mental health and public health problems? Okay, I'm going to give you your cases and yes. No, the children are different. Are different, and court cases have gone to court where parents refuse to have surgery on their children, and then the child becomes the ward of the court, and then the court makes the decision.
That's right.
Right of treatment has to do with who you individually, right? If that's what you do, and then you have to deal with the question of what's child abuse. Is child abuse a runner who, against her doctor's orders, decides that she's still going to run 5 miles a day all throughout her pregnancy, even though her doctor says that he does not or she does not think that's advisable? Is that child abuse? You know, those are the kinds of questions that one has to ask. They sound extreme, but that's the kind of issues one has to look at in relationship to it. Yes? I can, although this is, one of the things I'm assuming in the discussions is that's where a number of these things come up. What I've tried to give you here are some of the nitty-gritty legal issues and facts so you can have a discussion and include in that your, you know, faith system and what you understand in terms of your own theology and faith. And so that's kind of how I've developed. So let's try to do the case studies first, and then if we don't get what we need from that, we can come back to that question, okay? All right, let me give you a case study. I want you to go into small groups to have a discussion about it. The first one is Janet. Let's see. I think I'm going to give you this one. This is the case of a woman who was a heroin addict. She was a heroin addict, and she lived in a rural area. She was initially involved in a methadone program that she had to go to every day, but she had to travel 65 miles every day to get there. Her car broke down and died. She tried to hitchhike. Finally, she didn't have enough money, and basically she was dropped from the methadone program, so she stopped going. She was pregnant at the time, and she was ready to deliver. When she delivered, she was tested. The baby and she were both tested positive for having heroin in their system. At that time, the police and district attorney came along, and they took her child away from her, and then slapped her with charges of child abuse. And originally, the police wanted her to be charged with murder. The district attorney moved that down to child abuse, and she was put into jail. No, the child was alive. Child was alive, but the child was addicted to heroin, had to go through withdrawal. Okay? All right, that's the case. The question is, do you agree with what the district attorney and the police did? That's number one. Number two, what do you think the ramifications of this particular case are for other cases down the road? And number three, what do you think the role is of the church in this kind of a situation? Where should the church be speaking to this kind of a situation? Okay? Take a few minutes and get in a small group wherever you are and spend some time with that discussion. Okay. You need to stop? Huh? I know. All right. You want 2 more minutes? All right, do 2. I'm easy today. Huh? Oh, you didn't listen to me, so you guys. Busy discussing. I just gave them 1 more minute, which is going to be up in about 20 seconds. So. Okay, we do need to stop now if we're going to get there for the 5 o'clock dinner bell. So if people can turn around and how did people feel about the decision that the district attorney made? Think it was a fair one? What problems did you have with it? Somebody said no up here. You want to tell, who said no up here? I heard a no up here.
I said no down here.
Oh, okay. Yeah, why?
He didn't give her any credit for the effort that she made.
Okay. So the feeling was is that if she'd made an effort because it wasn't available to her, that she should not have been charged, but rather helped in the process. Okay, what about other people? Why do you think it was fair or not fair? It depends. It depends upon the drug. It depends upon what treatment's available. I mean, one of the issues we're facing right now is that there's just not enough treatment slots even available to deal with the issue. So the question is that a lot of those women aren't even getting treated. The treatment spots just aren't there. In many cases, in the case of drug use, the rates aren't real high in certain areas, especially if there's no support system, if the program is not readily available, if it costs a lot of money. I mean, there are many barriers to making a rehab program successful or not, and a lot of those barriers exist. So, you know, it depends upon what the circumstances of the person and what the drug is and all those kinds of things. So, but it's in many cases, I'll tell you, working with drug addict moms is really hard. The success rate's not great. It feels hopeless at times. It's real painful. So, you know, I wouldn't try to at all smooth that over and say, oh, it would be nice and rosy, because it's a big struggle. You're right. The question for us in our society is the issue of, do we treat this as a health problem or do we treat it as a criminal problem? And that's where a lot of the struggle is in terms of dealing with the issue. That in many cases, there is not good funding for maternal child health, for drug programs. And therefore, we have a tendency to solve the program by criminalizing it. And quite frankly, criminalizing it hasn't been any more successful. So one of the things you're dealing with is a lack of success in both areas. So the question for us is, what do we want to do? The other question is why are not women who are middle income and upper income women who are cocaine addicts getting the same treatment? They're not. They're not having their babies taken away from them. They're not being incarcerated. And that is clearly a difference in the justice system. You know, this issue of justice and equal treatment is one of the places up there. Yeah. Well, a couple things will happen, I will tell you, because they've already started happening. One of those is that. One is women will not seek prenatal care early because they don't want to get tested, because they don't want to deal with the law. Two is they will walk into emergency rooms to deliver the babies, or they will have the babies at home. And, you know, there's all kinds of other... It's one of the problems with trying to solve public health problems with the judicial system. And the issue is, for our country, that I think we really need to struggle with is, how much do we care about children? In some ways, we spend and focus a lot of our energy in this country on the fetus or the child when it's in the womb. The minute it's born, we forget it. There is not enough money to take care of those kids. They are not put in adequate foster care, even if they are taken away. They are not given the kind of education they need. So in many ways, we give lip service as a society about caring about those kids that those women are carrying. But we don't practice what we preach when it comes to putting our money down and spending the money. Maternal and child health money has decreased in the federal government over the last 8 to 10 years. We're doing less, giving less, than we ever have before. Drug treatment programs have decreased for pregnant women. I mean, there are all kinds of issues that point to the fact that we're not really serious about really taking care of children, that we seem to focus our attention on those 9 months of while that fetus is in the womb. And the question is, as a society, can we truly tell a woman that she can or cannot do something to her body during those 9 months when we do nothing to take care of that child for the next 21 years? That's where some of the conflict goes. That's one of the things we need to look at. What about what we do as a church? How can the church get involved in an issue like this? What can we be doing as church people? Should we stay out of it altogether? Is it any of our affair?
Support system?
What about some of the ethical issues? You talked about that back there. What are some of the issues that you think the church should be involved in?
For one thing, voting.
Okay.
There are a lot of church people that do not vote.
Okay, so to be clear that you're voting for somebody who supports programs for children. I do, however, think, though, that we need to look at this issue of responsibility toward humanity and rest of creation at the same time we looked at importance of human life and respect for others. That at the same time we are talking about the sanctity of life and protecting the fetus, we also have to be talking about dealing with children once they're born and dealing with women who are already here. That somewhere along the line, we have to be responsible all up and down. Secondly, we have to be respectful of others. That we have a tendency to look at drug-using pregnant women as lower than us, as different than us, as more problematic than us. And I will bet you that in almost every one of your congregations, there are probably some substance abusers that you have no idea, but they look good. They dress well. They act fine. And somehow we make those judgments. It's easier for us to accept that poor woman who doesn't look as good, who doesn't speak as well, okay, they can send her off to jail. But what about my next door neighbor who's been hitting the bottle pretty heavily during her pregnancy? Somehow she finds her way out of it. So as a church, we need to have compassion and listen to the issues, but also deal with all five of these in terms of what they mean for pregnant women and children being born. Okay, I want to let me do one piece that I want to finish, and then let me take your question. This is from George Annis, who is the professor of health law at Boston University, one of the major ethicists in the country. And I think he really says it well when he talks about all of these issues about fetal-maternal conflict. Attempts to define fetal neglect and to establish a prenatal police force to protect fetuses from their mothers are steps backwards in terms of both women's rights and fetal protection. Women's rights will only be fostered when we treat women equally. The best chance the state has to protect fetuses is through actions to enhance the status of all women by fostering responsible pay for the work they do, equal employment opportunities, and providing a reasonable social safety net, quality prenatal services, daycare programs. It's probably not coincidental that government's trying to blame the pregnant victim of poverty for their problems and at the same time is cutting funds for maternal and child health care nutrition. If the state really wants to protect fetuses, it should do so by improving the welfare of pregnant women and by not oppressing them. And I think in a lot of ways what he says in that is that we have to look broader than where we've been looking traditionally, that we have to stop blaming, in many cases, the victim, and we have to start defining systems that allow for healthy moms and babies. Most pregnant women want a healthy baby. Don't kid yourself. Most pregnant women want a healthy baby. There are all kinds of barriers, however, to that in many cases. Because the middle class and upper class women are not being prosecuted for their using it.
Is still being harmed.
Yes, because I think he's saying is that health care that would be available to those women. Some of those upper and middle class women are not going to prenatal services early, because they know in the process of doing that their drinking or their substance use is going to be detected. So just because you're upper and middle class doesn't mean you're necessarily seeking prenatal services. What he is saying in the process is that we need to treat this as a healthcare issue and not a criminal issue. That a criminal issue does no more for the safety and health of the fetus. And he feels that it would be better to put it in the care of healthcare. So I think that's the distinguishing mark to it. Okay. And to accept the fact that it happens within our own membership and not to just other people. And I think that's one of the issues. We have a tendency oftentimes in the church to think it's only happening out there. And it's really happening within our midst, and we need to be compassionate in listening to those people that it's happening to. I think that most people in the drug and alcohol prevention field would tell you that they think money is being misspent trying to keeping drugs out of this country, that in fact the money should be spent on educating people in this country and giving support systems for why people use drugs. So I think there's a lot of question in that field over how funds get used, and that is one of the key issues. That's right. And it is, it's a real conflict of what works. And again, it's that issue of does education and kind of pressure within society like we've done with smoking work better than law enforcement? And, you know, where do you spend your money? And it is a real issue. Okay, it's 5 o'clock, and I would be happy to stay here and talk to people, but I know some of you are hungry, and tomorrow we will be looking at the issue of AIDS, not from the point of view of what's happening so much individually with people, but from the point of view is what are some of the ethical issues we have to deal with related to forced AIDS testing, to quarantining of AIDS patients, to a whole lot of other issues that are going to impact us in the next 10 years. So I would be happy to stay if some people have things to say. And